Thank you very much, Neil. It's a straight up instruction. And thank you very much for asking me for giving this talk. It's really great to be talking to you all again. I spoke before also sometime, but like a year or 2 years back. And thanks for coming to the talk. So today I'll be talking to you about some of my recent works on how we can map the universe using multi-messenger observations, such as the gravitational waves and electromagnetic observations. So just to give you an introduction, like we as human beings have always explored the nature by multi-messenger probes. And one of the fascinating examples which I find interesting is lightning and thunderstorm. We see the light, we hear the sound from the system, and by combining both of these, we try to understand the physical mechanism. What about doing this for studying cosmology? Can you study the study cosmology using multi-messenger probes? And nature has provided us several ways to probe it. We have lights, we have gravitational waves, we have neutrinos, and an immense improvement in the technology over the last several decades has helped us to actually measure these quantities, such as from EM telescopes, from gravitational detectors, and from neutrino detector, to measure the signals deeper from higher registers. So the question is, what can you learn by combining these multi-messenger informations about the universe? For my today's talk, I'll be mainly talking about EM probes and the gravitational wave probes. I will be not talking about what we can learn from neutrino sector, but certainly there are several interesting aspects which one can learn about. So giving a brief introduction about the our observations in the EM sector, we have mapped the universe from over a wide frequency range, from radio, microwave, infrared, visible, X-ray, and gamma ray, over the almost entire sky. And this enormous amount of information has helped us in constructing the standard model of cosmology, what we currently think as our standard model of cosmology. We have understood kind of the what is the cosmic history, what are its possible ingredients. We have an initial map of which we have constructed from these observations, which kind of tells us that possibly at some time in the past, universe has started with a big bang, and there is an epoch of cosmic inflation. And then sometime around redshift of 1080 or so, you start forming the first atoms in the universe. Photons and matter got decoupled. Those photons started propagating nearly freely to us. But that's what you observe as a cosmic microwave background radiation. Here is the image of CMB as observed by Planck. After that, universe was pretty dark. There's not much stars. It is just a neutral state. And then sometimes around a shift 25 or 30 or 20, we start forming the first stars. We start ionizing the universe. And sometime around, we don't know yet properly, but between redshift 5 to 6, we reionize the universe completely. And currently, today, redshift 0, universe is kind of going through an accelerating phase, which we attribute to dark energy. And currently, our structures we see are pretty nonlinear, as discovered by several large-scale structure observations. And we have mapped from something like a pretty Gaussian initial conditions to a pretty nonlinear structure today. This beautiful understanding of about the universe had helped us in constructing what we call the standard model of cosmology. What is it? The LCDM model, our favorite lambda cold dark matter model, which is extremely successful in explaining nearly whatever we have observed until date. But there are still a lot of open questions, and there is quite a lack of understanding of this model. A few of the open questions in the field, which I have mentioned over here, are like, what is the current expansion rate of the universe? There is a big debate about its value. We don't know, as of now, what is the actual value of it. We don't know what is the CDM part of LCDM model, the cold dark matter part. We do not know how cold it is, what is dark matter. We have also a debate about our understanding on dark energy. Is it really a cosmological constraint or is it something else? We don't know. And more interestingly, the whole framework of our standard model of cosmology depends on the general theory of relativity. So one can ask questions that whether is the general theory of relativity is a correct explanation of gravity at all scales. And these are a few of the open questions which are interesting to me. And I find it using multi-messenger observations, possibly we can address this. What gravitational wave brings to us is that along with several currently available excellent EM probes, gravitational wave brings a completely independent probes to us to map the universe. The standard model of cosmology, which we have constructed, this same image I've shown you a few slides back, which is developed using EM observations. Now, using gravitational wave sources, stellar mass binary black holes, supermassive binary black holes, binary neutron stars, neutron star black holes, we will be able to actually see this cosmic history and understand maybe more deeper physics of it, and to make sure that our understanding of the expansion history and the cosmic history is same as we have developed from EM observations. And to give you a brief summary of how gravitational wave comes in over a different frequency range, here is a nice summary plot made by LIGO-Virgo collaboration, telling us about the range over which gravitational wave exists and its typical sources. So gravitational waves, pretty much like electromagnetic observations, ranges from something like 10 to minus 17 or minus 18 hertz to way up to 1,000 hertz and above. In the extremely low frequency gravitational wave, are produced from during the Big Bang epoch, which you believe to be is a like a holy grail of cosmic inflation, and it should be imprinted in cosmic microwave background B-mode polarization, which is possible to be measured from the several upcoming CMB experiments, which I've listed a few of them here, such as Bicep Cake, Simon-Sari, Simon's Observatory, CMBS4. And also from space-based gravitational wave detector, which is currently funded by JAXA, is LIGO-Virgo. Next comes about nanohertz gravitational wave signal, which is possible to be measured from pulsar timing array. These are the sources which are like super massive binary black holes, like 10 to 9 solar mass and so on. These are the potential sources which is possible to be detected from 10 to minus 9 hertz gravitational wave signal. Then as you proceed slightly towards higher frequency, something like millihertz gravitational waves, which is possible to be detected from space-based gravitational wave detectors such as LISA. And we expect sources of slightly lower mass, and now a mass around 10 to 5, 10 to 6 solar masses. Currently what we're observing in the extremely high frequency gravitational wave spectrum, which is possible from the current detectors such as LIGO-Virgo, Skagra is soon joining, and in the future from LIGO India, Cosmic Explorer, and Einstein Telescope, we are detecting what we call as a stellar origin black holes, neutron stars, and possible neutron star black hole systems. In today's talk, I'll be in particular talking about these two bands, or the science literature from these two bands, and it's not going to focus on the other two. So to give you a brief introduction of how these two different bands are going to explore the universe, I'm giving here a plot on the terrestrial gravitational wave detectors, ongoing in blue, the advanced LIGO as a function of gravitational wave source masses in x-axis, and redshift up to which gravitational wave sources can be detected in the y-axis. As you can see, with the advanced LIGO sensitivity, we can go something like few solar mass to something like 1,000 solar masses, up to a redshift of 1.5. But in the future, with the upcoming gravitational wave detector, such as Cosmic Explorer, which is shown by magenta, and Einstein Telescope, which is shown in green, we can actually probe the universe up to very high redshift, something like 70 to 80, where a mass range 1 to 10 to 4. This is the band which is possible from the terrestrial gravitational levitators. What about the space-based gravitational levitator, which is like LISA? As you can see here, again, in the x-axis, the plot shows the mass range. Now, the y-axis shows the redshift. As you can see, from LISA, we are going to observe slightly different sources, like few times 10 raised to 4, to 10 raised to 8, 10 raised to 9 kind of sources. Over the sweet spot, about around 10 raised to 5, 10 raised to 6. And the redshift range you'll be reaching is almost a redshift of 20. So you can see now that with gravitational wave sources, which are now very different kinds of probes for the universe, like previously used to probe the universe using supernova, using galaxies, using quasars, cosmic microwave background. Now black holes or binary neutron stars are a new sources which can actually map the cosmos to us. And we can start asking questions that with the availability of so many transient sources out to high redshift, what can we really learn about the physical cosmology? So here I'm showing you a plot in the left-hand side with a beautiful plot from Ries et al. Astrodecadal 2020 as a function of radius and angle, how the neutron stars in yellow and the black holes in white can be probed from different experiments. As you can see, with O2, we are much below redshift of 0.05 for neutron stars. For black holes, we are around 0.5 or so. And with advanced like A+, we are about 0.1, slightly above 0.1 for binary neutron stars. And for black holes, we can go up redshift of 1, above redshift of 1. And with CE, and this is much more promising, going up to very high redshift. This is a summary plot which I've shown before. So the question now is, using these sources, how can we map the cosmic history? That's one part of the question. The another part of the multi-messenger probe is whatever we have observed until date with multiple EM observations. We have indeed probed our low redshift universe with CMB, the high redshift universe. What can we understand about the black hole properties? How can we understand about these transient sources using the EM observations? So to me, this is look like a new paradigm for us to work on multi-messenger cosmology, where there are two sectors to this. One is, how can you learn from gravitational wave sector about the universe? And another is, from the current observations of EM sources, what can you learn about the gravitational wave source properties? In my talk, I'll be about this part, how can you learn about the universe from gravitational sources? And only partly I will mention about the second one, about how our current measurements from several EM observations can help us in understanding about gravitational wave properties, source properties. So the first of my talk, I'll talk about the Hubble constant measurement from gravitational wave sources. So this crowd, of course, knows that there is a big problem in our standard model of cosmology, that there is a disagreement between different EM probes in the value of Hubble constant. Here is a beautiful plot by Verde et al. In 2019, where they have basically summarized the results of several probes and shown that for early universe probes, which is like CMB and using BAO, you get a value of Hubble constant something around 67. Whereas from supernova observations, which are low redshift observations, Holika, the lensing observations, strong lensing observations, these typically show you something above 70, around 73 or so. So when you combine these observations, the low redshift observations, and you compare that with the high redshift observation, what you see that there's a discrepancy of around 4 to 6 sigma in the value of H naught. Now this is a tension, and we don't understand its origin. There is a huge amount of papers almost coming every day trying to explain this discrepancy in the basis of theory. If this is something new, physics, which it will be exciting, but we don't know yet. Nothing is compelling yet. Whether this is a systematic effect from either CMB or for the supernova or low redshift observations, we do not know, or it can be both of them. So one of the places where gravitational wave measurements can play a very interesting role is basically to nail down the value of Hubble constant from in the low redshift range, from a low redshift observations. So in the first part of my talk, I'll be talking about how Hubble constant can be measured from sources with EM counterparts. So when we measure gravitational strain, the measurement of gravitational strain can be directly related to the luminosity distance to the source. This was first shown by Bernard Schultz in 1986 that the Chirp property of the gravitational signal is an excellent way to basically measure the luminosity distance. That's the denominator of DL. And if such sources have electromagnetic counterparts, then we can measure the host galaxy. And if that galaxy have a redshift information, we can use the corresponding redshift of the host galaxy. And after doing a peculiar velocity correction, we can get the value of Hubble constant, H0, using this equation in the low redshift range. Certainly, there are several astrophysical uncertainties in this simple equation which can play a role. From the gravitational wave sector, one of the major sources of uncertainty is the inclination angle. It's the angle between our line of sight and the angular momentum vector. So to measure this quantity, if we have multiple polarization measurements of gravitational wave signal, like H plus and H cross, we can break the degeneracy between luminosity distance and inclination angle. Other possible ways of measuring the inclination angle is basically if we have higher order modes of the gravitational wave signal, which means that if along with L equal to 2 and M equal to 2 modes as the most dominant mode, if gravitational wave source have slightly anisotropy in its distribution, then the anisotropic information encodes the information about inclination angle. But whatever the anisotropy is, the luminosity distance remains the fixed. So by using the higher order modes of the gravitational wave signal, one can also break the degeneracy between the inclination angle and luminosity distance. Another interesting way of breaking the degeneracy between inclination angle and luminosity distance is that if there is an independent electromagnetic observations, like let's say I observe a jet for this or for the source, and I can have a kind of a constraint on its inclination angle.
Sivadeep, can I ask?
Yeah.
So for the events that have been seen already by LIGO, have these higher order multipoles been measured with any signal to noise or no?
Yeah, we have seen two. Mm-hmm. In this O3A, we have seen two of them with one of them pretty promising higher order modes. So one which those which are extreme mass ratios, those are the one which have a promising higher order modes. And we have indeed used that. I forgot the number, sorry about that. There are quite a few now. But the one, I think it's in the month of April, was the event, binary black hole event, that we have measured a higher order mode. And indeed, we are able to constrain, get a better estimate of the luminosity distance and the inclination angle.
Okay, like we're not sure of like how much this improved the estimation of the distance.
So I don't remember the number out of my head. It's like, if I remember correctly, so you remember this is a banana plot where basically you go almost 30 to 40% of the uncertainty is reduced from this measurement of the higher order modes. Because you kind of put a limit that it is not, whether it is minus 180 or zero, at least that plane kind of degeneracy you can break.
Oh, okay. So you can break sort of like, so you can somewhat break degeneracy.
Somewhat, not completely. It's like instead of a two banana things, one of them will be there.
I see.
Kind of, okay. Yeah, exactly.
Okay, thanks.
But it's useful if we have higher, we see many events with extreme mass ratios, then that is a promising channel to measure this.
Oh, so for EMRIs, you're saying you can
measure
order multipoles.
Yeah. So the way it originates is basically if I have one small and one heavy one, when they're moving around, I basically see an anisotropy in its emission of the gravitational wave. And if I can measure that, therefore I can have an information about this about the inclination angle of the orbit.
And for EMRIs, do we also get good distance measurements the way that we do for these more equal mass ratios?
You mean for EMRIs from LISA kind of sources?
Sure.
Yeah, so for there, yes, we will be able to get a better estimates if we can do a joint estimation. I have not done that yet for MREs, but definitely with the higher order modes, this property will remain the same.
Yeah, but I thought that for MREs, we still have difficulty even computing waveforms.
Uh-huh. Oh, that's another challenge. Here, everything comes with the fact that we are able to reproduce or at least get to a good phenomenological or numerical iterability waveform to get to the signal. So for the LIGO-Fargo noise level, we at least have a few waveforms which are dependable. I'll show you results, which that also started breaking down now. But if we have a waveform which are significantly accurate, then only all of these measurements make sense. I completely agree with you, yeah. Otherwise, definitely we'll have larger uncertainty with the theoretical waveform itself.
So then when you are talking about using these MREs to get distances, you're imagining like some future in which we can compute reliable waveforms, and it turns out that we can then convert those waveforms then into distance measurements.
That's correct, yeah. I am completely assuming that the theoretical modeling of the waveforms will be accurate or will get accurate eventually for LISA. Yeah, that's true.
Okay.
That's actually an interesting, a huge amount of people are actually working on it to make waveforms accurate enough for LISA to get the science goals done. Yeah.
Okay, great. Thanks, Surbit.
Thanks. Yeah, sure. So these are the only problems in the sector of luminosity distance. There are also certain problems in the numerator part, like the peak luminosity measurements. One can do peak luminosity estimations by several techniques people have already proposed. So if we do so, like LIGO-Fargo collaboration have done that, then from the gravitational wave events such as GW170817, one can measure the value of Hubble constant with not significantly high accuracy with one single event. You cannot expect that. But this is like going to change with more and more events. I'll discuss that soon. But indeed, we have a first measurement of the value of H naught from a gravitational wave source. For this particular event, we are very lucky that not only we had an electromagnetic counterpart, but we also detected the jet using radio observations. So if we can include the radio observations and get a constraint on the inclination angle, then this estimation of the H naught can be improved. And that is what is performed by Hotoseka et al. In 2019, where they have included the VLBI observation of the radio jet. And then from this orange curve, you go to the blue curve, where you can see that there's a significant amount of degeneracy from the inclination angle and luminosity distance is broken, which helps in getting a better constraint on the value of H naught. So let's assume for now that we are going to have good waveforms to get to the DL. We are able to get the break the degeneracies with the inclination angle, and we have a reliable peak luminosity correction method.
But wait, so
please go ahead.
Can you explain more how we use these VLBI observations, measure the inclination angle?
So what happened is, for this kind of particular source, they have observed the jet. When you observe the jet, then you can model it, like what is the typical angle it is making with the orbital plane. As a result, then you get a kind of a posterior on the inclination angle, on the jet, or the angle it is making with the orbital plane, and put that information together to get a constraint on the luminosity distance. And then you see that the part of the luminosity distance, which is kind of, let's say, this region, is now completely ruled out by this observation.
Yeah, but my question was about, what exactly in the data is constraining the inclination?
It's the orientation of the jet, maybe? Is that what you're asking?
Sure, yeah. Like, so how do you get the orientation of the jet?
Oh, so they have seen the... they have mapped the using VLBI, they have seen that what is the typical orientation of the angle of the radio jet with respect to us. And then they fit a model to it to get a model between, this is what they call a power law model of the jet, to kind of fit it with a underlying cosmological model and luminosity distance. So this goes together. This inclination angle constraints are actually depends on the value of luminosity distance. So you have to do it together when you've got the final value of H dot.
Like, is it something about like the polarization in the VLD?
No, it's not the polarization. It's just basically seeing like this is the plane. If this is the jet, they kind of measured this jet, and then they estimated what is the kind of angle you expect with the oriented with the orbital plane by making simulations or simple models.
You mean they actually reconstruct the image and see a little jet feature in it?
They have measured the jet and then try to model it with respect to the orbital plane.
So does that they have simulations of neutron star mergers where they produce the jet and then
So they have simulations and also they have simple form parlor forms which they have used. Not by the polarization yet. I mean, for this one, it is mainly from the jet. These results are only from the jet measurement.
I guess I'm still like, sorry, this is an announcement. One second.
Okay,
well, this is still going on. Okay, anyways, yeah, so I'm still, I guess, like, you know, I'm still not seeing like what exactly in the image is telling you what the angle is. If the angle were like 1 degree or if it were like 10 degrees, what would be different in the observed image that we see?
Oh, you are saying, so is it like a face on to a sort of completely like face off?
Suppose that it's like almost face on, but it's like 1 degree misaligned versus like 10 degree misaligned.
Oh yeah. These errors are huge. It's like a 40 degree inclination angle error or something like that, yeah. We are talking about, I mean, it's not like a 1 degree or 10 degree. It's like really big error which you have able to constrain for this error.
Okay, so say it's 40 degrees versus 10 degrees,
So it's the brightness of the jet you kind of model.
Oh, the brightness.
There are, after this particular event, there are several observations made where people try to model the source, like how the source looks like. And from the several radio, so this is one for radio, but there are also observations in other frequency bands by which people try to model it, the particular source, like how this binary neutron star source may be looking like. And then if you assume such a model, then you can get a constraint on the jet. So this is very much model dependent.
Right.
Very much model dependent. That's why it was not in the LIGO-HARGO result. Yeah.
Right. So therefore, like the systematic
is large. Systematic uncertainties can be significantly large, which is not taken into account in this blue results, blue plot. Yeah.
Oh, is not taken into account.
It is not taken into account. If you have a systematic offset in this, let's assume this. Okay, like your simulations are not correct, then you are possibly having a completely wrong result. It is still okay. We are matching the maximum accurate value, but it may be completely wrong result. That is still
I see. Like, so therefore, if you rely on this VLBI stuff, then you're saying that the systematic error, might be larger than the statistical error.
Can be, yes, because we always believe a model here. And our whole assumption is that our current belief of the model is correct, then what the estimate we got. That's the kind of argument which they come up with. They never vary different models to show that's not possible because that is quite expensive.
I see. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Sure. Thanks for a good question. But I should clarify this. This is one of the reasons why these results were not included in the LVK. This is not an LVK result. LVK results are much robust. That's the level. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Sorry. One second.
So I should just, shall I present?
I think you can go ahead. Yeah.
Okay. Thanks. Yeah. So good. So if so, we are maybe able to get a value of H naught with luminosity distance and measurement and the ratio measurement, then how accurately can we measure the value of H naught? So this is a result from Chen et al, 2017. And you can also see similar conclusion from Finney et al, 2018, where they have shown that if we measure the luminosity distance to the gravitational resources, without assuming that there's a jet measurement or anything. It's just DL measurements. And we have the corresponding electromagnetic counterparts to these sources. Then what they have shown is that with about 50 gravitational resources, one can get something like 2% measurement of value of H naught for these bright binary neutron stars. So in 2017, with that time known rate, it was they thought that it is possible in the next 5 years, which gives a time scale of 2023. But as you know right now, that we have only one bright binary black hole, binary neutron star system until date. That is like 2020, so somewhere here. And we do not expect to get to this kind of 2% accuracy by 2023. Our these estimates are going to have to wait longer. But this is definitely, as you can see, is a very promising window to get to accurate measurement of the value of Hubble constant from bright neutron stars. What about other kind of bright gravitational resources, if they exist at all? One of the sources are like black holes. Usually we do not expect any electromagnetic counterparts from binary black hole system, stellar origin binary black hole system. But very recently, ZTF discovered a potential electromagnetic counterpart for the gravitational wave event GW190521. According to that, so this is a sky map of LVK collaboration. And in that, this blue cross is the observation made by ZTF. They have seen electromagnetic counterpart at a redshift of 0.438. So now you can ask, if these two signals are associated, then can you make a measurement of Hubble constant from this observation? Indeed possible, because now we have a luminosity distance measurement from GW190521. And a redshift measurement from ZTF. If you combine that, here I'm showing you the corresponding plots for 190521 for different waveform models. So here I would like to point out the point which Neil was mentioning before about the accuracy of the gravitational wave waveforms. Please notice that depending upon what gravitational waveform we are using, IMR phenom, inner surrogate, effective one body, the posteriors are slightly different on the value of H naught, because the distance estimates are not correct, are not same. So indeed, there is likely a systematic effect between different theoretical waveforms, which is playing a role in these different results. The main effect of these two events is that the H naught value is kind of in the lower range, like 0.4, 0.6, something like that. And when you combine this with GW170817, that's the yellow line, you get the dark red dotted line, this one, which kind of gets close to the measurement of Planck collaboration. And when you combine that with the VLBI observation, which I have shown you before, so VLBI plus GW170817 plus the ZTF observation and plus the gravitational waves from 1905-21, you get the value of H naught, which is kind of close to what is observed by Planck. But I would like to say this is, we are not in a position to resolve any tension. We are not in a position to assuredly tell you that this is, we are not in a position to tell you whether these two signals are 100% sure related. So there is a lot of still open questions, but it is true that this is an interesting channel. The interesting part about GW190521 is that it is the heaviest black hole we have ever measured until date. It's like total mass is like merging of one like 85 solar mass, other one is like 65 solar mass, and combined mass is like something like 150 solar mass. It's pretty heavy, and we don't expect to see it such source as usual.
Sorry, may I ask a question? So do you think is going on? Why is the result so bad? So if I just look at the assumption of this redshift from the potential coincidence with the different waveforms, why are they different so badly?
Because, so this propagates from the uncertainty in the waveform models.
But they are not
some of the waveforms
If the waveform models are this bad, why would I believe any other result from LIGO? That's what I'm asking. So what
yeah, we don't know. So for this kind of sources, so for this particular event, it turns out that the waveform choice has a huge effect on the luminosity distance, and it is now several groups are actually working to get to a better understanding of the effect of gravitational wave waveform, theoretical waveform, on the measurement of H naught.
But this was a system that roughly similar masses, right?
One is 85, one is 65, so roughly similar. The problem is we have seen the signal for a very, very short time.
Sure, even better.
Because it's super, super heavy. We've seen it for a very short time. Another problem is, we don't really know its spin or its precision plot. Several of these waveforms don't actually take into account arbitrary spin and precision. So there is a recent result by, I forgot the name of the first author, it's Gayathri et al. Collaborators. They have done a very interesting result of actually doing the simulations with precision and for arbitrary spins in, and they argue that possibly such a system is present in a baryonic disk, okay? It's like an AGN. And they come up with a completely different set of cosmology, different set of parameters, luminosity distance parameters, and also gravitational source parameters for this particular event. You should definitely check it out, the paper by Gayathri et al.
Yeah, I understand that, but with the source that is in band for such a short time,
mm-hmm.
why are all these features mattering? I mean, they shouldn't be that relevant. So I'm confused as to something's going on in this hybridization of, well, whatever.
Models, you mean, yeah.
Pseudo-analytical models are prior to mergers together with the numerical relativity results and the post-merger. Or I intuitively, I just don't know how they can have such a large effect.
One thing I'd like to point out to you that most of the checkings we have done for the simple analytical models or phenomenological models is for a very limited parameter range of spin and precision.
Yeah, that so I understand, but I think
we are really off in our true parameter space, we don't know how these waveforms are going to behave. That's the challenge.
But this waveform should not be too complicated. That's what I'm saying. So I think one has to redefine the template bank and not use what you have been working with for such a long time, but you accumulate signal in the in spiral. So mm-hmm. I think gotten into a scenario where the merger is not very well resolved
mm-hmm.
because
mm-hmm.
you have weighted all the templates heavily more on the in spiral.
So that's an interesting idea. Yeah, I didn't think about this. I mean, yeah, that's an interesting way to do that too.
All right, thank you.
Yeah. Thanks for this question. I have to think about it more. Someone else was also talking.
Yeah, is it also redshift dependence, the inaccuracy of waveform? Do they go?
So for the waveforms, we only so the distance really doesn't matter. It's an overall scaling.
Mm-hmm.
So, and the ratio dependence goes into the distance part, but what really matters is the intrinsic parameters to the gravitational resources, like masses, spins, inclination angle, precision.
But the DL error
doesn't... DL is like an overall scaling. It's like a high signal or low.
Okay, so it goes already into that. And
that's right, yeah. So that's how we measure the DL value, but waveform shape is not going to change because of that. Yeah, it can only affect because of the amplitudes. But you can see, as Luis was mentioning, that it is indeed a lot of effect, right? I mean, this is not a minor effect in the luminosity distance. So we need to worry about the possible systematics which are now coming can play a role from the model, theoretical modeling of the waveforms.
I was just going to say, is the big uncertainty just coming because, I mean, I think of the luminosity distance as being extractable if I know at a given frequency, what is F dot and also what is the amplitude, mm-hmm. but in the post-Newtonian regime. And if you just don't see much of the post-Newtonian regime, then...
Yeah, we have not seen much for this particular
event. Then maybe
event.
You just intrinsically will have a large uncertainty in the luminosity.
Yeah, and also for this event, there's a 50% error on the luminosity distance. It's typically very large error. for this particular event, because we have only seen a small the signal for a very small amount of time. Is that answer your question?
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, sure. So I just proceed now. So if this option is an interesting channel, that indeed measurement of gravitational wave sources with electromagnetic counterparts such as binary black holes, one can measure the value of Hubble constant, but these are now sources tightly up to high redshift. So you not need to marginalize over omega m and dark energy equation of state. So we see that what is the kind of measurability from this kind of sources in future, if we see them more. What we find is a similar conclusion with binary neutron stars, is that we are going to see something like 2% measurement of value of Hubble constant. We can infer 2% measurement of value of Hubble constant with about 50 objects. But please remember, here I have not included any uncertainty in the luminosity in the gravitational wave waveform modeling. So if my waveform modelings are wrong, then I'm basically going to completely affected by that error. And also another problem is that we do not know the rate of these events. I cannot tell you whether we are going to see one more event tomorrow or we're going to see one more event after 10 years, because we really have seen just one right now. We have a very poor estimation of the rate of such events. We need to see at least one few more to really confirm that this is a potentially good, interesting channel. So one of the important take-home messages until now is that most of the sources we have seen are not likely to have electromagnetic counterparts. For up to O3A, we have seen about 50 gravitational wave sources, out of which we have one source, GW170817, which has definitely a confirmed electromagnetic counterpart. And the other one is this, GW190521, for which we are not pretty sure yet about whether they are related. But if related, they're interesting. But so it is, let's say 2 out of 50, okay? We have a chance of seeing bright gravitational sources with dark gravitational sources. So now I'll talk about, what about gravitational sources without electromagnetic counterparts?
Yeah, may I ask you something?
So please, yeah.
What is the supposed mechanism behind this electromagnetic counterpart?
That's an interesting one. So nobody knew about when they have seen it. Later, when the measurements were done, people have studied about this effect in details, and they have proposed that there is possibly a baryonic present, I mean an AGN disk of a heavy black hole around which there's an AGN disk, and these two black holes are in the disk. Mm-hmm. And we have seen the electromagnetic counterpart from the disk. This is our current best guess, I should say, for explaining the ZTF event.
Okay, thank you.
And now let me just add here. So if this model is true, then there are these gravitational waveforms need to really thinking about, is there any effect or what are the effects of the medium on the waveform? And how accurately we can deal with it? That's something also we need to worry about.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, sure. So, now talking about sources without electromagnetic counterparts. First of all, the advantage is that these sources are going to be like black holes, heavier masses. So we can see them up to higher redshift. And if we can see them up to higher redshift, we cover a larger volume. So we see more of them in number. That's something we are seeing currently. But if I do not have electromagnetic counterparts to the gravitational wave sources, then I cannot do a simple C times Z over DL kind of relation, because I do not know its redshift. So I need to infer the redshift from this gravitational sources without EM counterpart, which we call a dark silence. So I'm going to talk about that part now. So let's take this cartoon example here, where I'm showing you a few dark silence which I have drawn by these yellow stars. And let's say for all these sources, LVK have measured the luminosity distance. As you can see here, that I have distributed these gravitational sources kind of inhomogeneously in this slide, in this image. Let's say this is my sky. And the reason behind that is because we don't expect the gravitational sources to be distributed randomly in the position, but rather to follow the underlying distribution of matter. So wherever I have more galaxies, if I just switch this one to these two, wherever I have more galaxies, let's say these dark regions here, I expect to see black holes there more than the region which is like this white region, which is like a void. So we can expect that the underlying distribution of the astrophysical black holes are likely to follow the distribution of galaxies. If this argument is true, then there's a we can see how a single pair of galaxy and gravitational waves should look like. Let's see, let's focus on this one of them, okay? We can see that around this one black hole, this dark siren, there can be several other galaxies. And one can now use the spatial clustering between the gravitational sources and the nearby galaxies to measure the clustering ratios. Sorry for introducing this jargon suddenly. Let me step back one more and explain slightly more. That if I now take different gravitational sources and ask at how these gravitational sources are kind of clustered with these galaxies nearby, can you use that property to find this redshift? And we can call that redshift as clustering redshift. This is an interesting procedure. What you want to do here is, let's say that that yellow star over there, you put radiuses of different values, r, and you are asking, what is the excess probability of finding galaxies around the gravitational source for a given sky volume of galaxies and gravitational sources? And that excess quantity is going to depend on the underlying correlation function. The beauty of the cosmological correlation function, this xi of r, is that it is very peak at low values of r. So this means objects which are nearby are slightly more clustered, correlated, than the objects which are far away. If this is a promising window, then let's see what I'm talking about and whether can this be used to measure the redshift of the gravitational resources for which we have not measured the electromagnetic counterparts. So what we are proposing that one can do a cross-correlation of the gravitational resources with galaxies. So let's take again this simple cartoon image here. In the left-hand side, I am showing you a sky patch where, let's say, we have measured quite a few dark sirens in the luminosity distance space. This means I have measured their luminosity distance with some error bars. Over the same sky patch, let's say I have a measurement of the spectroscopic galaxies up to some redshift. And this is the observation made in the redshift space. Now, what our job in the hand now is to basically calculate this excess probability of finding gravitational galaxies around gravitational sources by doing a cross correlation. What we propose now to do is that you can take a narrow bin of gravitational sources in some DL, and you take a redshift band in your galaxy survey, and you calculate this quantity shown over here. This is what we call the cross correlation. When you do that, let's say for this particular redshift, your DP value is more or less consistent with zero. I am showing here your graph, a cartoon graph, where as a function of redshift. So you go to the next redshift value, you again see something consistent with zero. You go to the next redshift, you see slightly higher probability of this DP value. Then you go to the next redshift, again this value goes down. So now possibly you have associated this redshift bin with a higher probability of associating with this luminosity distance bin of the gravitational resources. If you do this for all branches of gravitational resources or different luminosity distances and correlate, keep on doing this process for the different redshift range of the galaxy surveys, you can make an estimation and of the clustering redshift of the galaxies. And by jointly estimate the DL and Z together, and using the expansion equation for the expansion history, one can now measure the value of Hubble constant and other cosmological parameters. So we do this job from forecast from mock simulations. And what you see is that, so for this particular simulations, we have taken gravitational resources for LIGO, Virgo, Kagra network of detectors. with sky's colocalization area about 10 square degree, distributed up to something like redshift of 0.5. And you can see with about 50 gravitational resources, we can make a measurement of something like 3.3% or 3.5%. And as we go to something like 200 gravitational resources from LVGA detectors, we can make a measurement of about 2% of the value of H naught, which is shown by this blue line. And we can possibly, so one thing to remember here is that previously I have told you that with 50 gravitational resources, bright binary neutron stars, we can reach a 2% measurement. Whereas with binary black holes of 30 solar masses of LVGA light detectors, with about 200 gravitational resources, dark sirens, we can get to a 2% measurement of H naught. So this is a promising window to basically because we are going to have a lot of dark sirens for which you do not have electromagnetic counterparts. And if you can use this clustering aspect between galaxies and gravitational waves, then we can measure a value of H naught. As you can see, this method is kind of successfully able to get to the injected value in the simulation, that is this magenta blue, magenta line. And if this is possible in the future, by LIGO-Fargo-Kagra and combining with SGSS measurements and TUMAS and so on, we'll be able to actually break the degeneracy between Planck and Schuss.
Could I ask you something?
Please.
In your mock catalogs, So do you like, how do you distribute the sirens? Do you just randomly pick galaxies?
That's right. So here we have taken, thank you for asking this question. I forgot to mention something. So these results are actually marginalized over something called as the gravitational wave bias parameter. And this exactly connects to your question. How have you distributed the black holes? For the particular mock, we have distributed the gravitational resources randomly. But when you have done the analysis, we have not assumed that particular assumption. We have completely kept that bias parameter free and let it jointly fit together with H naught and omega m and the gravitational wave bias parameters. So we have marginalized over that.
Okay. So
is that answer the question?
I think so. So you produce, you do some in-body simulation or something. We don't
do in-body simulation. We take an in-body simulation. We then choose galaxies from that, of certain mass gas. Then we say, okay, I will randomly distribute gravitational resources with the LVK-like DL error bars on the sources with and sky localization error. Then I get a distribution of them at each different redshift bin. Then I do a binning in the luminosity distance of these sources. And then I take the same catalog of underlying gravitational resources and I do a cross correlation. And I keep on doing it for all different slices.
Right.
But what I have not assumed is that underlying population of gravitational resources, that it is constant, and how am I distributing it? This I have not assumed. I have told you that I don't know, so it fit it jointly fit it. I'll show you in the next slide the joint results.
Okay.
So do I understand correctly that you still assume linear bias between
yes.
the... Okay.
Yeah.
So how...
Yeah, I still assume linear bias because the error bars in the gravitational resources are pretty large, the sky localization error. And we are still seeing the very large scales or very low K values. And we assume at those scales, the bias will be not very scale dependent. But I should point this out to you. Including bias scale dependent bias parameter, we'll be still able to get these measurements, but we have to wait longer. I may not get in 200 objects, maybe I have to wait for 500 objects.
Yeah, I also wonder how much it will bias the central value or can affect the central value.
I mean, I'll show you, give me three slides. I'll show you, it's not degenerate, yeah. But okay, I'll show you that, yeah.
Can I just ask a basic question? I think there's something I didn't understand about the previous slide to this one. Why were you drawing the luminosity distance as a spherical shell, but the redshift as a vertical stripe as opposed to a bit of a spherical shell?
Wait a minute. You're talking about this one?
Yeah.
No. This I think is just a simple diagram.
This
is my bad drawing. Okay.
I see. They're both supposed to be bits of a spherical shell. Yeah.
Exactly. This is just my bad way of drawing.
Sorry. Okay. Just thought I was missing something.
Yeah. No. So thanks, and yeah. This is the
background. No, sure. Go ahead. Sorry.
So okay. So now, if with dark silence, I told you I'm able to use gravitational forces up to high redshift, the standard question now comes, which already part of the thing which you have already asked me, is how the gravitational wave sources distributed with respect to dark matter. We don't know that yet. How gravitational wave sources are biased. And also, we can now ask questions that can we reconstruct dark energy creation of states using dark standard silence. First question. It's the second question, which already you are asking me before. Let me answer that at first. What is the gravitational wave bias parameter? This is an extremely interesting question, and I have we currently have no clue about it. This is a quantity which depends upon the star formation rate, the property of the galaxies, whether it's a star-forming galaxies or it's a not a star-forming galaxies, or the typical metallicity of the galaxy, and also whether there are environmental effects, like signatures of assembly bias, which you see in galaxies, what is the imprint of that even on the formation of the gravitational sources, stellar mass gravitational sources. So all those uncertainties currently we plug in terms of a scale independent but redshift dependent gravitational wave bias parameter, and we model it as something like BGW 1 plus z to the power alpha. Soon after our paper, there was a work done by CISA group who has done a simulation of using a prescription of star formation and metallicity. Made a kind of a phenomenological reconstruction of the gravitational bias parameter for binary black holes and binary neutron stars. And very interestingly, they have shown that the bias parameter is again very much like a power law structure. So this assumption is pretty much right. But I must mention that it is not yet explored what is going to be the scale dependence. And that's something currently I am working on to really understand how gravitational wave sources are going to depend on its host properties. Can I understand something about from our current EM observations? Like if I take several data about galaxy properties, can I construct or develop an understanding of the gravitational wave bias parameter? And this is where I would say that where the other aspect of the multidimensional cosmology plays a role, where we're going to learn about the source properties of gravitational waves from EM observations. So now I will show you the result which I was talking to you before. So I didn't show you the joint contour for H naught, sorry for that, but this is the same result, similar contour you also get for H naught. But here is a joint contour for the dark energy equation of state and the gravitational wave bias parameter, these two parameters, for 280 gravitational wave sources distributed up to redshift of 0.7. As you can see here, when you do a joint estimation, your typical error bar on the dark energy equation of state is like you get a 30% measurement of dark energy equation of state W naught. The error bar on WA is typically large for this number of sources, and this is mainly because of large sky localization error. But the gravitational wave bias parameter with BGW, we are seeing we can get a value of like, so our injected value apparently was 2, we recovered in something like 2.35. And the error bar is something like 0.6. So we can typically make something like 3 sigma measurement of the gravitational wave bias parameter for in this cross correlation setup jointly with the other cosmological parameters. What is interesting, now it comes to one of your questions, and what are the effects on the mean value or inferred value or on the degeneracy? At least for the scale independent bias parameter, which we have explored, we don't see a huge degeneracy in the parameters because of this three-dimensional clustering property. But I do not know currently how much this will get affected if I take a scale-dependent bias. And this is something definitely we should do in future. Does that answer the question?
Could I ask just to make sure I understand it right? So because in your mock catalog, you randomly put the source sirens on the galaxies. So your mock catalog, the actual bias would be bias of the galaxies, which was that one also constant?
So we don't take it the same bias. We sometimes populate it with slightly higher bias. So galaxies are taken with a bias of 1.6. And gravitational resources are taken with the bias of two.
Okay, so you experimented with that, I see.
Yes, and good point. Please go ahead,
And that one also was not redshift dependent.
That's right. In the mocks, it's not redshift dependent, but in the analysis, we have taken the redshift dependence. So you can take that alpha dependence, zero is the injected value, and you get something like minus 1.03. That's what you get from this results.
Okay, sounds good, thanks.
Yeah, so if merger rates are going to be redshift dependent, which is possible from, if you believe that let's say it's going to follow star formation rate, or let's say Meadow-Dickinson star formation rate, then you're going to have a redshift dependent gravitational bias parameter. And that's going to be encoded in terms of alpha.
But is there some reason, to think that the scale dependence or the redshift dependence would have any effect on the cosmology inference?
Actually, it is, This is a big problem in the analysis. The reason behind this is as follows. We never measure source masses. We always measure redshifted masses. Now, when you are drawing the distribution, when you are saying at a particular redshift, let's say redshift of 0.6, what is the probability of I get a black hole? What mass? So you assume an underlying mass profile. We usually take something like m raised to minus alpha, where alpha current values are like minus 2.35. Now, this is a model in the source frame, but not in the observed frame. Now, when you do this transformation, this Jacobian transformation, you have to assume underlying model. If you don't do that correctly, then you're going to have a wrong inference of the value of H0. Is that answer your question, Neil?
No. In the cross correlation.
Mm-hmm.
If I assume that the bias is scale dependent, or if I assume that it's redshift dependent, as well, that wouldn't affect the location of the peak of the cross correlation.
Right. Exactly. That's why it is not. That is why we are able to break the degeneracy.
Yes. So therefore,
the cross correlation.
Scale dependence or the redshift dependence matter, I guess, is my question.
See, the scale dependent, I am not sure, because let's say that I have a correlation function. Because of very bad property, my correlation function peak property in the GW galaxy correlation is smoothed, okay? It came down. It's not very peaky. If that is the case, then I'm losing a lot of information because of scale dependent bias. I can think about it like that. Are you able to see my hand, like what I'm trying to say?
But again, if the bias is scale dependent, spatially scale dependent,
mm-hmm.
how would that affect the location of the peak and redshift in the cross correlation?
It will not affect a lot. I believe so, but we have not done that analysis yet. Our assumption was that it will not affect any redshift dependence we have taken into account. But one problem which remains in my head always the time. But let's say I completely take a very weird bias parameter, which makes my gravitational forces slightly off the peak, okay? Then every time I do a cross correlation, I am within the same range. I'm seeing a peaky behavior, but I'm never hitting the right value because there it is significantly smooth, let's say, the correlation function.
Well, you're already smoothing the correlation function,
Within the
correlation errors on the event.
Yeah, that's right. So with
and that smoothing is like tens or even hundreds of megaparsecs.
Correct. Yeah.
It's just hard to see how this scale dependence would have any effect whatsoever. But
yeah, I agree with you. I mean, that it may not have any effect as such, because we are going to see that peaky behavior at the correct redshift bin. But I mean, I think I need to check it out for confirmation that it is indeed the case. I mean, our current understanding, that's why we have not taken into account the scale dependence. I mean, I didn't take into account the scale dependence with this understanding that it will not matter at all.
Mm-hmm.
But you never know. I mean, unless you're missing something very weird or like that, yeah. Is that answer the question, Neil?
Sure, yeah. So how much more do you have, Subhadip?
I know. How much time do I have?
Well, we're over already by a few minutes.
So you can tell me. I can skip up some of the materials here.
Well, if you could wrap up in maybe a few minutes, that would be awesome.
I mean, 5 minutes or 10 minutes? Present there?
Yeah, 5 minutes maybe.
Okay, I see. I'm sorry for taking more time. There's a few questions, so yeah, I just process fast.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Sorry for taking more time. Yeah. So I think I will just to cover this last aspect. I will not cover about my last topic. So let's now say that what next we can do with gravitational lensors. If you are seeing a lot of objects like black holes and further out in redshift, one of the interesting window which opens up is testing alternative theories of gravity using propagation of gravitational wave. So this is again a simple cartoon diagram. What I'm trying to show you here is that if gravitational signals are emitted, it's shown by these red waves, depending upon your underlying theory of gravity, the propagation of gravitational wave in space-time can lead to a different observable signature. So in non-GR theories, there can be additional terms in the gravitational wave propagation, such as gamma z, which is like the running of the effective Planck mass, or like the speed of the gravitational wave can be different from speed of photons, or there can be a mass to the gravitational wave, mass to the graviton. From the GW170817, we have seen that these quantities, both of these, are consistent with the values of GR. But we have very poor or constraint or nearly no constraint on the value of this one, which is like the damping of the signal. So the effect of this gamma z is that if, as shown here over here, if it is less than zero, you see something like less amplitude of the gravitational wave signal than expected. And if it is positive, then you see something like an enhanced gravitational wave signal than it is expected. So the main imprint of this particular effect is in the inferred luminosity distance of the gravitational wave. So this is how your gravitational wave inference gets affected because of this gamma z parameter. And one of the ways to parameterize this model, this signal, is by this xi naught parameter and this its independence. So what I have recently shown, I think this slide we can skip for timing. What I have recently shown is that that to measure this quantity from observations, we need at every redshift an independent luminosity distance to these gravitational wave sources, which you do not have if it's a dark siren, or unless you're assuming a cosmological model. But nature provides us an excellent scale to the in the cosmological perturbations. That's the BAO scale. So can I use the BAO scale to relate it to the gravitational wave sources? So what we have shown here is that the angular diameter distance and the luminosity distance of the gravitational of the EM probes are related, and which in principle is connected with the angular scale of the BAO. So when you combine the from data the gravitational wave measurements, GW inferred at a particular redshift, which you infer from the clustering, and at the same redshifts, you calculate the theta BAO from the galaxy surveys. So the left hand side is completely from data. This quantity should be just behaving like 1 plus ZRS if there is no modification to GR. And if there is a modification to GR with the scale, with the redshift dependent or not, you can measure it by fitting this formula. And here is a result from, again, from the same marks, but now with this alternative theories of gravity parameters I naught, please focus on these dark blocks here. You can see that we are going to measure this parameter with something like 4% to 25% accuracy. And there's a large error in the value of n. This is dominantly coming because of very large errors in the sky localization error at high redshift. So you're not able to reconstruct the shape very well, but we are still able to get the xi naught parameter with significant accuracy, which is not possible with bright standard sirens possible from LIGO for Gokagra. So people only thought about doing this kind of measurements from bright neutron stars, from Einstein telescope and cosmic explorer. But with this method now, with about 2,500 objects, we can get to something like 4% measurement. But if you assume a value of redshift dependence, then you can get to something like 2% measurement of gravitational waves, measurement of this xi naught parameter, for gravitational sources varying from 2000 to 10,000 after marginalizing over all other five parameters. So the typical time scale we expect for these events, assuming the merger rate and the rates, is that from 6 to 14 years. we can get something like 3,500 gravitational resources. So I think I'm out of time now. I should not take more of time. I'll not talk about gravitational lensing at all, and I will just go to my conclusion. And I can discuss about this in the question time if you want to know something about it. I'll just leave this, and I will just go here. So whatever I have discussed with you until now, one of the key summary I say is that to achieve these science goals, synergy between different experiments is a key thing. And we are indeed at a golden era of multidisciplinary cosmology because of several upcoming experiments which are coming. We have gravitational wave detectors such as LIGO, Virgo, Kavra. In future, we're going to have LIGO India. We are also going to have space-based detector in next decade like LISA, and in 2040 timescale, Cosmic Explorer and Einstein Telescope. We are having several large-scale structure surveys such as Euclid, Raman Telescope, Vera Rubin Observatory, SphereX. We have DAISY, Dark Energy Survey. And we have CMB observations such as CMB S4 and Simons Observatory. And so it's a real playground now to basically combining observations which have very different capabilities to actually measure and very new things about our universe by combining EM sector and GW sector. So with this, I will basically end my talk with a few take-home messages. First one is that with gravitational resources, irrespective of whether we have electromagnetic counterparts or not, with about 50 bright sidons and about 200 dark sidons from LIGO, Virgo, Kagra, we can measure the value of Hubble constant to 2% accuracy. With the help of this cross-correlation technique and able to go up to higher redshift, we are indeed able to now go into measure other properties such as dark energy equation of state from gravitational wave parameters, from gravitational wave observations, which will be extremely interesting. By combining EM sector, like the BAO scale, with the gravitational wave sector, the luminous resistance measurement, a completely new way of testing theory of gravity is possible at the cosmological scales within next within this decade, at least to a significant accuracy. And which I couldn't discuss much about today is that this is also a very promising window to see dark matter properties using gravitational resources. With this, I will end my talk and I'll take more questions. Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks, Suvadeep. So let's all unmute to give Suvadeep a round of applause.
Thank you.
So in view of the time, maybe we should stop here. If people have further questions, please just remain on Zoom, as we can bug Suvadeep some more, maybe after the official, talk has ended. So let's meet again next week. Okay, goodbye, everyone.
Thank you very much, and sorry for taking more time.